It was very refreshing for me to chant the Anuttalakkhana Sutta. Each time going through the phrases, the different stages of that, and just using each section as a reflection to turn it back on oneself. And so these words, the words of the Buddha, have a depth to them, they have a seriousness to them. Rupang anatta. Form is not self, they translated it. And the word form here means the body, means anything we can perceive with the body, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, even our memories or imagination of these things also comes under rupa. We imagine a house in our head, little red roof and green window shutters, then that's a rupa, even though it's just in our mind. That's why it's a little bit difficult to translate into English. You either have to use a specific but not very accurate word like body or matter, or you have to use something very vague and not very meaningful like form. But anyway, the purpose of it is not so much to get the categories right as to offer a framework for reflection. Body is not self. It's such a relief. We can't wish, may my body be like this or may my body be like that. May what I see be like this or may it be like that. This physical realm that we inhabit, it just is how it is. It's cold one day, it's warm the next. And if you look at what human culture and human life is about, so much of what we are is about trying to manipulate and control rupa, our physical environment, you know, the very origins of human culture, lighting a fire inside a cave. That's the beginning of the end, lighting a fire, and that's why we don't have a fire in this cave. It's the beginning of, once you've got a fire inside a cave, then you've got air conditioning and you've got global warming and it's just finished. It's all downhill from there. Because it's at that point that you start saying, I can control rupa. I can say, be like this, be like that. And the further we go with our technology, then the further we want to be able to control it. We want to live forever, we want to change our appearance, we want to fix up all the broken bits of our body. So much effort poured into trying to go against this way of nature. But at the end of the day, it's quite astonishing really if you look at how much effort and time that's put into these things, and at the end of the day how little that you can do. And how little difference it makes. When you think about it, you think about, you know, all of the fabulously wealthy people in the world, and all they can do, the houses they can build and the yachts and all of these things. I mean, is their rupa, their environment, is it actually any more beautiful or any more amazing than being in Bandhanoon at Santi Monastery on a lovely warm winter's day? With the sun shining through the trees. All the things, all the culture that we've done to try to improve our rupa, and really, it doesn't get much better than that, does it? The sky doesn't get any more beautiful. the birds don't sing any more sweetly. We pour ourselves into those things. And at the end of the day, they don't really matter. When we're coming near the end of our life, all of those things, they're going to fail. Our rupa is just going to fail, no matter what we do. I was just talking with my mother and her husband, my stepfather. His rupa is finally collapsing on him. They've had to take him into full-time care and to look after him. He can't trust his rupa just to walk around. He used to be a strong man. He was in the army. He used to be able to do sports. He was intelligent and competent. He ran a law firm. All of these things he could do, and now he can't even stand up without help, without people around him, just in case he falls over again. So there's really not all that much we can do about it. It's really just kind of nudging around the edges, improving things a little bit here and there. So the Buddhist practice is not to forever be putting money and time and everything into trying to make our body or our physical environment perfect. We're trying to fix everything. Just good enough. If we have a roof above our head, if it's not too cold in the winter, not too hot in the summer, if we have good friends, family to be with, food to eat, clean water, clean air, we don't need too much more to be happy. If we don't have those things, then yeah, we've got something to complain about. But if we've got all those things, then we're doing okay. We're really doing okay. Rupa, Vedana. Vedana, feeling, pain, pleasure. Neither pain nor pleasure. And again, that's what we spend our lives chasing, isn't it? Pleasurable feelings, trying to run away from painful feelings, falling asleep when there's neutral feelings, getting bored. So always look for some kind of stimulation. And it's quite, it's kind of animal level of existence, isn't it? Not meaning any disparagement to animals. They're at that level because that's where they're at. But it's a human problem that we still kind of run around at the beck and call of these kinds of feelings. Actually, feelings really should be there to serve us, shouldn't they? They're kind of, from a biological point of view, they have a function. They keep us alive. You know, a pleasant feeling of food encourages us to eat more of it, so we sustain our body and so on. And the bitter taste of things that are not food makes us want to not eat them. So these things have a purpose. But of course, because we get attached to them, then our pursuit of these feelings, our involvement with them, it goes way beyond their useful extent. And so the Buddha said, of course, that with pleasant feelings we tend to have greed or desire. With painful feelings we tend to have aversion, wanting to get rid of them. And with neutral feelings, mind tends to just lose interest, drift off. Like if you're just walking down a street and nothing much is there, you just start thinking about this and that. not really focusing on what you're doing. And boring tasks is sometimes the hardest to bring your attention to. So all this is in how we respond to feelings. Of course, the feelings themselves are just natural. It's just how the mind works. It likes some things, doesn't like other things. It doesn't care about other things. It's just perfectly natural. And so the mind just goes on sending these signals, but we keep on getting involved with them so much. That's why this reflection, vedana anatta, feelings not self, it's very liberating. It's just conditions. They just come and they just go. I feel sad. It's just a feeling. I feel happy. It's just a feeling. So it's very important in Buddhist practice that we don't try to repress or deny any feelings. And this is something that we see quite a lot in Buddhist circles, of people who somehow think that they shouldn't feel certain things or afraid to face certain kinds of feelings because that's not what a good Buddhist has. Of course, that's not right. The real practice, just you feel it, experience it, but you don't get too involved in it. You're aware, you're mindful of it. Reflecting, oh, okay, that's what that feeling's like. And then when we reflect on it, then it doesn't have such a hold on it, on us. We still feel it. The feeling's still there, but it doesn't have such a hold on us. And so we understand that these things are all going to pass. And somebody who we love, we just want to be with them so much. It makes us so happy to be spending that time with them. One day they don't make us happy. One day they do something that really pisses us off. We get really angry and really upset. And then you get so depressed and so sad. How can it be that somebody I love so much that I could have this argument with? Because it's impermanent. These feelings are impermanent. And very often we don't understand them. What is it that makes us happy? Why do we like one kind of food and not another kind? Why do we like the company of one person and not another person? We're often driven by these unconscious preferences and forces and so on. But very often we tend to define ourselves by what we want and what we like. So I know that very well because as a musician then, you know, of course I'd be a terrible snob as a musician, you know. If somebody wanted to go and see some kind of top 40 covers band or something like that, I'd just be in despair, you know. No. And if I managed to let myself get dragged along, I'd just have to just stand in the corner sulking and having the most miserable time. Professionally. Why couldn't you just, you know, just go along with it and have a dance or whatever? No, I couldn't do that. I had to stand in the corner and sulk. So actually, it's very interesting that a lot of what we think that we like and dislike, a lot of that arises from triangulation. That we like something because somebody else likes it. It's actually very hard to make up one's own mind about things. Film has got good reviews, so then you think you'll like it. Or if a restaurant has, you know, got a good star rating in the restaurant guide, then you think the food must be good, whatever. Or you see because your friend has it, or somebody at work has it. Somebody on TV has it. So the triangulation of desire. You want it because somebody else wants it. I did that as an experiment once when I was a busker. I was once playing the guitar on the streets in King's Cross late at night. And for some strange reason, I don't know why, but somebody gave us a whole carton full of cold beer, which is a very unusual thing, but then unusual things happen at King's Cross almost every night. So here we are, and we just tried to give it away, just as an experiment. And people were walking past, and we'd offer them a can of beer and say, here, you know, it's a closed can of beer that we couldn't put anything in it or anything. And tried to give it away, and we couldn't give it away. No one would take it. Which is probably lucky for us. We probably would have made bad karma by giving it away, I guess. But anyway, I didn't think of that at the time. So they'd rather go into the bar and pay $5 for it, rather than just get it given to them. So this is how our desire works, our craving works. It's all triangulation. We're measuring and comparing. So actually that our basic physical responses to things become very much tempered and trained by our perception, by our memory, by our ideas. It changes how we experience things. And that's, of course, the next one of the five khandhas is sanya, it's perception. Once the raw feeling sort of starts to be processed in our mind, we start to interpret it. We start to see it from one particular perspective, or filter it, or shape it. And this is happening all the time. You know, if we think about all of the information that is available to us at all times, you know, we can, now that we have digital media, we can quantify that. We can quantify the amount of bits of information that are present in the air when I'm giving this Dhamma talk. At the end of the talk, we can look at the memory, it's recorded. We can look at the size of the memory there. There's so many bits. And of course, we know that the amount of bits that are actually captured, they are only a tiny fraction of the ones that are present in this room itself. But so many thousands and thousands and thousands of bits of information. And somehow we have to make sense of that. So that's what sanya does. Sanya puts it all together. Make sense of it, so we don't operate on the world of atoms or of light rays or of sound waves or of bits of information or of pixels. We operate on a world of people, of caves, of doors, of words. And these things have all been put together. The information at the kind of lower level has all been put together and worked up for us into a form that we can actually deal with. And that's before we even got it. We're like getting the executive summary of everything that's happening. We're just catching the headlines. And somehow we have to make our way in the world just by reading the headlines. And so everything we ever see and do and think and know is all filtered in this way. So how do we think that we can ever trust anything? How can we trust our ideas, our opinions, our thoughts? We can't. All of these have been filtered by sanya. There's a world that's created in our mind. And again, if we look at it from a biological point of view, then the criteria for what kind of world you build, it's not how good it is, how accurate it is. It's just how it enables you to survive. That's the only criteria. So we've got no kind of guarantee that the world that we're being presented with, that the world that appears to our minds, that how true is that? How real is that? And of course, there's so many examples where our perception is just so good at filtering things out. And one of the most famous examples of that was the experiment that was made, very famous, by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And I actually saw it when he gave a talk in Sydney. And I found it absolutely incomprehensible, because I'd read about this experiment before. Very simple experiment. He shows a film. The film has basketball players, one with white shirts and one with black shirts. And you're supposed to, the audience is given a task. They have to count how many times the white shirts pass the ball between them. So you're sort of watching the screen, concentrating on watching how many passes the white players pass the ball. Meanwhile, a man in a big gorilla suit walks out in front of all the basketball players, thumps his chest, and then walks off. And you're watching, I'm just watching this thing, and this guy in a gorilla suit, he comes out right in the front, thumps his chest and walks off. And then Jon Kabat-Zinn, there's like 400 people in the room. And Jon Kabat-Zinn said, well, did anybody see anything unusual? I was just shocked. I was not only so shocked that most people didn't see it, but you honestly cannot believe this. Quite a few people didn't even see it on the second time. I'm gobsmacked. And these were psychologists, by the way. Most of them, they're health professionals. Amazing, huh? That's how powerfully our mind is filtering things all the time. All the time. So we can't control it. It's not self. It's not us. You don't have to worry about it. Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it. We just get by. So, I mean, it's actually something that's quite astonishing. I don't mean to sort of criticize them, in the way that Sanya works is actually quite amazing. Very sophisticated. But we can't get too involved with that, the way we see things. There's always a different way of seeing. Always. And the problem is that it's on the basis of that inadequate way of seeing things that somehow we have to make our choices. And choices are always based on too little information. And when we make a choice, every single time we make a choice, we are essentially just rolling a die or flipping a coin. We actually don't really know what is the right thing to do or what is not. We think we know, but we think we know because our sanya is telling us, our perception is telling us. But we know that that can't be trusted. But we have to make our choices anyway. And so this is sankhara. Sankhara khandana. Fourth of the five khandas. Intention, volition. That also is not ours. That's not under our control. It's causes and conditions. Our predispositions, our experience from the past. What do we want to get out of things? Our own sense of self, our sense of identity wanting to preserve itself. And somehow we end up making some kind of choice or other. Faced, do I go left or do I go right? And somehow at the end of the day you've got to make the choice. That's all. This is our sankhara. Sankhara khanda. So sankhara is like the active part of the mind. And it's the part of the mind which I guess we feel like we have more control over. And I guess to some extent we do. We feel like we're kind of more involved in those choices. But then often, you know, it's interesting when we look back and we wonder, could we have made different choices? What would have happened? We don't really know. So this is what that sankhara is about. Do we do good? Do we do bad? What direction do we take our mind in? And that's the real bummer of it, isn't it? We have to accept responsibility, but we never have enough information to make a choice. That's life. So again, we can't control that. It's always like that. Doesn't matter what choice we're making. Doesn't matter what situation we're in. We always have to make choices. So this also is not self. It's not me. It's not mine. And when we reflect like that, then we let go of these things. You have more space around it. It doesn't mean that you don't make choices. And this is, again, something which I think can be a failing in Buddhism, is that we Buddhists often prefer to be passive. We think that by not doing anything, and somehow that's always the best option. And that's just a failure to use our sankhara responsibly. The Buddha himself was very decisive, very active. But he wasn't at the slave of his sankhara. He knew that this is just how it is. It's just the khandhas, it's how they work. So we don't agonize about it. Is it the right choice? Is it not the right choice? But rather than agonizing about the choices, we reflect on them. Oh, okay, that's how it is. Make that choice and that's the result. And it's not fair. None of it's fair. Why should it be fair? And the last of these five khandhas is the vijnana, the awareness. That's probably the best translation. Consciousness, knowing. And vijnana is that which knows all of the other khandhas. It's not the sight, it's the knowing of the sight. It's not the sound, it's the knowing of the sound. It's not the touch, it's the knowing of the touch. It's not the thought, it's the knowing of the thought. It's not the memory, it's the knowing of the memory. And so this consciousness, this vijnana, is very, very subtle. And similarly, the Buddha used was that vijnana is like the lord of the city, sitting in the middle of the crossroads. It's very evocative, isn't it? If we turn inward and just reflect on that, somehow how it feels, isn't it? It feels like our consciousness, the awareness itself, is somehow just sitting there, knowing. Just knowing. Just knowing. And all of the ephemera pass through like clouds. Sights come and go, sounds come and go, feelings come and go. And there's something that stays still, very quiet, and just knows all of that. This is vijnana. Awareness. So this vijnana is by far the most subtle of all of these aggregates, and it's the one which remains. Actually, all of these five aggregates were things which in the Buddha's day were taken or were assumed by various thinkers or philosophers or whatever to be the self. Seek something that's eternal, something that's lasting, something that's a refuge in one or other of these five khandhas or in them taken together as a whole. And part of the nature of this process is that we tend to move from the coarse to the refined, from the rupa through vedana, sanya, sankhara towards vijnana, we're sort of able to let go of these things one by one. So for example, you know, most people, when they approach death, will at least on some level, will disidentify with their body. And they realize that they're not their body. And they'll often, for example, believe that they're a soul or some kind of immaterial entity or something like that. So it's quite natural that we tend to disidentify with the relatively coarse aspects of these khandhas, and then what remains is taken to be the self. And it seems that in the Buddha's day, and I think it's also true to say today as well, that the most subtle forms of theory about self, most subtle kinds of attachment to a self, were all about this vijnana, this awareness. It feels so, I don't know, so eternal. So it's always there, isn't it? You can't, you know, sights come and go, but somehow there's a sense of knowing that remains. And I can kind of imagine myself without a body or with a different body or something like that, but I can't imagine myself not knowing. Then when we come right down to it, I think this is really at the core of our sense of identity. This vijnana. So what the Buddha pointed out was that although it might appear to be eternal and just there all the time, actually our vijnana is constantly changing. It arises because of causes and conditions. And it changes. And we all know that, don't we? That, for example, when we go to sleep, yeah, our vijnana, our consciousness changes. We're barely conscious. We don't really describe that as consciousness anymore once we're asleep. It becomes, it's a borderline case, is that conscious or unconscious? But whatever it is, it's certainly different than waking. And while we're awake too, our consciousness changes. Sometimes we feel very bright, our mind's very aware, we clearly know what's going on. Other times we're very dull and sleepy, or maybe our consciousness is scattered and going to different places all the time, or sometimes it may be still. So it has all these different qualities. It's constantly changing all through the day. So this is essentially the difference between Buddhism and the Upanishadic philosophy. The Upanishadic philosophers believed that there was a kind of unconditioned consciousness which was just purely eternal and not affected by the conditions of the world. And it's what they claim to be the self. And the Buddha said that actually all forms of consciousness are conditioned. So it's in this contemplation particularly that is helped by developing subtle states of meditation where we can catch a glimpse out of the corner of our eye of consciousness in the act of changing, in the act of betraying us, in the act of not being as real and substantial and steady as we'd secretly like. So that's a little talk for you this evening on the five khandhas as not self. I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Often in Tibet, it's four of them talked in singular, sankharas and plural. What does it mean with that?
To be honest, I don't really know. It may be just an idiom. There are various kind of explanations for that which are given, but I don't find any of them particularly convincing. So I suspect it may be just an idiom, and that it's not something that should have too much meaning drawn into it.
We also see a lot of the egrets that do quite a lot of persistence when it's inquiries, like decision or something called desire and really stick. Not permanently, but for a while. So.
Yeah.
The idea of being mortal, mortal sort of by the lack of this, like themes.
Yeah, I don't know. As far as I know, there's nothing in the suttas themselves that discusses that. So.
If people kind of consider their sankhara as like it's not mine, then how would they kind of take responsibility for what they got?
Well, yeah, if you took that teaching the wrong way, that could be like the snake you're grabbing by the tail, couldn't it? Well, in a sense, you're not responsible. So, but with all of these things, it's really nothing. It's just that each of those ways of seeing things applies at a kind of a different level of practice. Yeah. So, in terms of our choices and ethical life and so on, applies at a level of sila. And so, what we're talking about here is at a level of liberating wisdom or very profound wisdom. So, but I think it's quite true to say that if you taught or emphasized that teaching out of context or in the wrong way, that it could lead to that kind of misunderstanding. But in terms of wisdom teachings, and there's really no issue. It's just like all of the khandhas or everything. It's just there's responsibility, but there's no one to be responsible. That's all. It's like there's feeling, but there's no one to feel it. Or there's consciousness, but there's no one to be conscious.
I think the point is, if you want to say that it's decision is non-self, you also have to be really good at saying that the result of feeling is also non-self, if you get reasonable or peaceful.
Yeah.
It's slightly higher.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Can you please explain the distinction between this is not me, this is not myself?
Okay. Yeah. Sure. In the sutta, the Natalakana sutra, it's a kind of stock passage. Eso hamasmi eso. Eta mama eso hamasmi eso me atati. So it has three phrases. And first one, etam mama, is this is mine. Eso hamasmi, this I am. Eso me atati, this is myself, or else the three negations of those phrases. And each of those refers to a specific aspect of the idea of identity or of a self. And in each case, is driven by a distinctive underlying force or tendency in the mind. So if we say etam mama, this is mine, or the opposite of it, this is not mine, then this is referring to the idea of grasping or ownership. Yeah? So this is essentially driven by a sense of desire, wanting to have something, wanting to own it, wanting to possess something. Eso hamasmi is the underlying tendency there, is the tendency of, and they call in Buddhism mana or conceit, which is just the tendency to, the most basic tendency to identify as a self. So in a sense, that's the most basic of all of them, most fundamental of all of them, eso hamasmi. And that's regarded, it's the exact phrase which in the Brahmanical text is like the first word uttered by Manu, the first man, is ahamasmi, I am. So this is like this identification. Yeah, this is what I am. So it's that kind of feeling. It's like an intuitive feeling or sense of identity. And the last one, eso me ata, this is myself. This is driven by, this is more of an intellectual thing. This is driven by theorizing of actually where you come from those sort of more instinctive drives and then you actually formulate a theory of the self. So you say, you know, my soul will, after I die, my soul will go to heaven and I'll live forever in the sight of the Lord or something like this, where we actually have an articulated concept of what our self is. Does that make sense? Okay, so maybe we'll finish up for this evening.
Arham Sama Sambuddho Bhagavan Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivade Swakhato Bhagavata Namo Namam Namasami Supadipanno Bhagavato Savaka.